Developers, 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 developers. Yes!
Hello, and welcome to the Static Void Podcast. I'm Jess Chadwick.
I'm Todd Snyder.
And I'm Chris Gomez.
And we are your hosts. We're recording this on the evening of June 5th, 2017, after a long hiatus, or let's just call it a paternity leave, right? Because I had a daughter who, back in January, the last time we recorded, I thought she was sleeping through the night. I think I mentioned something about it back then, but now that she's almost 9 months old, I think she's finally got it.
Yes.
And I'm finally getting some sleep. So now that I've been away, sleeping or not sleeping this whole time, what have you guys been up to?
Same things, right? Just keeping up with .NET and being involved in the community. And I'm putting together a Kids Can Code Night for those of you in the Philly.NET community. It's coming up here in June.
Nice.
And then I also did a webinar for the folks, the kind folks at PostSharp. They're interested in giving back to the community and doing developer-related webinars. So they asked me if I would talk about coding with Visual Studio Code in Linux and doing your .NET Core development. So kind of a gimmicky talk from that perspective, but I spent the entire time in the Ubuntu desktop Linux VM, and we acquired .NET Core and made a new project and built the website and even shipped it off to Docker Hub and got it running in Azure Web Apps. And so it's pretty fast because it's only 45 minutes, but you can check that out. It's on the PostSharp blog. Probably easier to Google, but we'll leave a link in the show notes, I'm sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah, nice. That's awesome. Yeah, so they had seen your talk at New York Code Camp, right? And were impressed and said, can you come and show that online to the internet, share it with the world and not just New York?
Yeah, I thought it was nice. You know, they reached out to me and I was definitely flattered that they had said, hey, our users would be interested. And I think we had, live we had something like 300 attendees. And I know that they get many hundreds of views over the next several months. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Todd, what have you been up to?
Mostly working and just trying to keep up with the crazy world of the web. Nice. Seems like every day there's a new framework or two. And obviously ASP.NET Core and Core we can talk about today and stuff. Just trying to keep up to date. A couple weeks ago? So a lot of interesting things came out of that. I know we're going to spend some time kind of talking about stuff and just
live. Do you guys watch all the build videos?
All of them, yes.
All of them came online. There's like a couple hundred, right? I mean, that's crazy.
A decent amount, but it is, you know, you fall behind so quickly and then you just sort of feel overwhelmed.
Yeah. I've actually watched about three or four and I've watched a couple of them twice. So I'm kind of wasting my time there. It's not very efficient. So, all right. So now that we're back and we're playing catch up on our favorite topic, right? We're just going to jump right back in, go back to the old, the old standby .NET Core.
.NET Core.
Right. So, and in this episode, we're going to answer some frequently asked questions that have been asked while we were out on break. People are asking a lot of questions. I know you got a couple of questions. A couple of these questions are from your presentation, Chris, right?
Right,
so
yeah.
Some of the Linux ones, the cross-platform ones, but also, questions that we get out in the community and just from friends and family. You know, my mom is big on asking .NET Core questions.
Nice. Wow, that's great.
So, all right. So I'm just going to dive right into it with, let's say, perhaps the second most popular question. I'll just kind of tease that a little bit because we're saving the first most popular question for the end. So the second most popular question, does .NET Core have the same APIs that existed in the full version of the framework? Like, for example, does system.web.security exist in .NET Core or system.web?
Yeah, system.web at all, right? Which is, system.web's a big old no.
Yeah.
But the idea here is not that ASP.NET Core is just a re-implementation of .NET framework, but cross-platform. I feel like they did two things. They left out things that were obviously very Windows-specific. For example, there's no WPF because that's at its heart based on DirectX. Mm-hmm. So that's just one example. But then at the same time, I think they left out things that maybe had iterated a few times. For example, I think if you're a .NET veteran, you know that I think there's three, maybe four ways to make a web request from code. But that have evolved over time. One was in system web, like there was a web request and now there's HTTP system.net.http is where you want to be using the async stuff. So, you know, why keep the old ones around? So things that were Windows specific are out, things that probably should have maybe you know, they've been superseded, or just things that I think also they redesigned. Like, hey, we could really streamline this. So it's not an identical platform.
So, but that being said, I think it's fair to say that many of the APIs, many of the namespaces that they did carry over, many of them are... I'm choosing my words carefully. Let me just start with the comparison that I'm trying to make. So way back in 2003 or 4 or something, there was something called Compact Framework, right? So I was working on kind of a small embedded system. So I was actually on Windows CE or Windows Embedded. And so on there, we were using the Compact Framework. And using that framework after using the full framework or switching back and forth between the two was incredibly frustrating, because that framework would have the same exact APIs, except instead of 10 methods, so system.string, right? The overloads or the extensions for system.string, you know, two string method has something like 10, 20 overloads or whatever, right? On Compact Framework, you would have two string, but it would only have like three of the overloads. And it was incredibly frustrating, because you would go, you would get IntelliSense and you would say, yeah, there's the two string method, but not that overload that you were looking for, right? And so it was, to me, it was kind of the same approach of let's take the full framework and just chop it down to exactly what we need, except I always seem to need what they thought I didn't need anymore, right? Where with .NET Core, I'm having, it's the same kind of principle, the same idea, but I'm not having that same experience, right? I'm just not, if I go to use something, it's generally there. Or in the case of like system.web, it's basically being completely rewritten, because this is the time that they're embracing, like, this is a rewrite of the framework. Let's clean up that old cruft. Let's do things right. And in the case of system.web, let's just completely rewrite it. In the case of the other stuff that was there, like system string, you know, with a two string overload, hey, we got it right. It's good. Everybody's used to it. You know, let's just carry that forward and use that.
And of course, you know, MVC and Entity Framework Core, they're concept compatible, right? So you should recognize the code, but your code does not port.
So that's the thing. Yeah. So you still have things like an HTTP context, and it has something like, it has properties called request and response. It's just, they're not at all the same APIs that you're used to. And those are really good examples of, you can't just pick up your old code and recompile to .NET Core, especially when you're using those kinds of APIs, especially in the system.web space. But when you are used to using those APIs and writing fresh code against them, most of your muscle memory of saying context.request or context, you know, most of that kind of works. And so with the help of IntelliSense and using IntelliSense to kind of discover the new APIs or what they're calling the new stuff, most of it's there. It's pretty natural. It pretty much works.
If early on, I think they used the word feature. I don't know if it was feature parity or feature familiarity. But concept compatible. That's the word they were using. That's the idea, right? You want to look for, hey, I want to return an adjacent object. Basically the same approach. It works, but the API might be slightly different, or definitely in a different namespace and different runtime.
Yeah. Well, the bigger problem is when that backfires, right? When you've used so much, the concept looks so familiar and it's almost exactly the same, except not, right? And then, you know, you're looking for that one API or that one method that you had used before, and you have no idea where it is. In some cases, turns out, hey, it's not available at all anymore. Yeah.
It does seem like they are starting to move some more and more stuff into .NET Core. I know when they did some of the announcements in Build, they were talking a lot that I think they added 800 new namespaces or something. I don't remember the exact number, but they're starting to bring more and more things over. They realize that makes sense.
That's huge. Well, so speaking of bringing things over, The next question we have here is, we know that VB support for .NET Core has been announced. Is it available today or is it still vaporware?
Yeah, it was announced a long time ago too, right?
Yeah.
And then it sort of, then we didn't hear anything about it. I remember not hearing anything about it for a year.
Yeah.
And then sort of a surprise to me, the notes for .NET Core 2.0 preview, which was announced and released at Build. Well, not announced, but released at Build.
And it's where says, we are today as of this recording, right?
Right. Yes. As of this recording June says, 5th, yep, yeah. VB is ready, but for .NET Core, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And so that's, the grammar here is so difficult because I've taken to trying very hard not to call .NET Core a framework because we already have the .NET framework.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then that's great. Let's just make it more confusing. So there's .NET Core, and that is not the same thing as ASP.NET Core, which is built on top of it. It's your ASP.NET layer,
yeah, uh-huh,
which runs on both .NET Core and .NET Framework, but we'll just leave that aside because that's a whole other confusing show.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we've sort of figured out, Jess, is we know you can do VB in .NET Core, but not seeing it in ASP.NET Core.
Yeah, so I've got the I've got Visual Studio 2017 with the latest update, the one that's been released recently in the past couple weeks. Yeah, the preview update. And so that has .NET Core 2 item templates, project templates. And so when you go in and you look at the C# section, you look under the web, you've got your ASP.NET Core web application. When you go under VB, you've got some .NET Core options under VB project type. But you've got a project or a class library and a console application. So where you would have three in C# with the web application being the third one, you only have two here. I don't really understand that. I mean, if you're making an assembly, if an MVC app in particular is just kind of a .NET assembly, where's the gap there?
Yeah, I don't know. it's interesting, but it's like, without really putting a ton of thought into it, you feel like, well, I thought Roslyn solved this, but there's probably something that I don't understand about why you need to support the language in .NET Core and why they were able to ship .NET Core 1 with C# and F# support and VB waited. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Again, since this is preview, right? I believe the roadmap has 2.0 coming out in third quarter. By then, the tool, whatever required, the template missing or whatever needs to be there, may be there.
Sure. Maybe
it's more about the current state of things that it seems like if you're doing ASP.NET Core, VB is not a valid choice.
Right.
Right. And if you want to use it today, that's the other tricky thing is that, and you want to use Visual Studio tooling, there's Visual Studio 2017, which we're seeing updated more and more frequently, but now there's this Visual Studio 2017 preview that you install side by side.
Right.
And you're keeping up with two trains of Visual Studio. It's not for the faint of heart anymore.
Yeah.
So we need bigger solid state drives just to keep all the right versions.
Yeah.
Because
you
probably still need 2015 for your day to day work. And
yeah. No, that being said, I've had pretty good experience with the 2017 installer and the installation footprint, right? It seems
the minimal installation.
The minimal installation and just what you need. I've been very happy with it. It's been pretty quick, too.
Now we know why they added it, because they realize you're going to need two different versions of Visual Studio installed.
Right. Like, don't click the Unity workload, right? Because not only does it install. It installs Unity.
Yeah.
So there goes several gigs.
Yeah. All right. So the next question is, speaking of what is here, what is available, what's not available. And this is honestly, this is my question. Plenty of people have asked me as well, but I've been asking this question and this is one of those ones where I kind of Google every couple weeks because I just don't believe. But where the heck is SignalR for ASP.NET Core?
Yeah. Right?
Like, where is it? When is it going to be released? Because Damian Edwards and Fowler, David Fowler, several years ago, I swear it was several years ago, we're talking about, hey, we're going to bring SignalR over. Yep. And as far as I know, I think it just became lower priority. You know, they're trying to get everything else done. But here we are several years later, and I'm Googling it a couple months back saying, okay, I'm ready to use it. You know, let's go. Where is it?
Right? Yeah.
And I spent a whole night trying to figure out what is going on. Okay, it's not here yet. When? When's it coming? So I think if you watch some of the build videos, what did you guys see in the build videos that you did watch?
I saw the SignalR talk, which I think is really interesting if you're into SignalR. And, you know, SignalR, again, concept compatibility, right? Because it's not the same. I feel like they're taking a step back from things that they felt either customers weren't using or were complicated, like putting this new SignalR version that they're creating for ASP.NET Core. They have some new abstractions they're working on, and I don't know how. I feel like they decided, let's rewrite this thing. They're getting rid of the jQuery the jQuery requirement, which made a lot of sense, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's what customers want. Customers want less dependencies.
Yeah.
And I think jQuery was around purely to make IE6 work.
Yeah.
So,
and they're publishing it as a pure node module, right? The client-side library?
They're going to have a node library for client, you know, JavaScript and others too. Like, they're really kind of pushing the envelope. I think they announced that there would be a Java one. It might not be there today. Like, they really want the client side to be very cross-platform, even though, and then the server side is ASP.NET Core. But, you know, it's still slated for now. It's on the roadmap as a .NET Core 2.1 release. Mm. So not even trying to make sure it gets into .NET Core 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's taken a while. And I know there's been a lot of frustration. People, you know, people who love SignalR, they might want to move over to .NET Core. And a lot of them feel like they can't. That's what I'm definitely even seeing, like, on the Slack chat and so forth.
No, that was my experience. That was my personal experience. Just last month, I started a new project, and I needed that real-time interaction with the web, and I didn't want to run the full .NET framework. I'm done. I've moved on. And so that's why I was looking for SignalR, right? And it wasn't there. So I just went and I threw a Node application together with Socket.io, and it was a couple dozen lines of code because it was simple. It was a simple need, right? If it was a more robust need that I had to really learn how to do a lot of stuff in server-side Node that I'm not incredibly familiar with, I probably would not have done it. But this was just a simple thing. I needed to sync some clients, right? I needed to sync some data between a couple of clients in a live fashion. Really just simply a message bus, right? Client A talking to client B and keeping them in sync.
Yeah.
And so I threw a node application together. But I would have loved to for SignalR to be there and to implement that in SignalR. So I can't wait for it.
Yeah. So still, I mean, you know, when Microsoft says third quarter, that means end of third quarter, right? So that doesn't mean
that's a whole window,
right? It's a window, so it doesn't mean July.
Yeah, but they were doing demos and build, right? I mean, it was they were alpha.
Oh, in fact, but the GitHub repo's there.
Yeah,
you can get it today, and you too can experience the bugs and issues. But it's further along than it was, say 4 months ago, where it was like, holy cow, you know. I don't know, playing with fire here.
Yeah.
It's solidifying. You could go get it. And, you know, for example, they're really pushing TypeScript as client of choice, although there is a JavaScript client. Actually, the TypeScript client is the JavaScript client.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
love that. Love me some TypeScript. Glad we got to get a TypeScript reference in here. Thank you.
Yes.
Oh gosh, yeah. TypeScript's moving on, right? And I mean, I recommend that talk that Anders did on TypeScript. Anders.
Sure.
It was very enlightening for someone like me who has been on the fringes, like, oh yeah, I know there's that thing over there. I haven't looked at it yet.
All right. Next question. Does it make sense to run your .NET Core apps on IIS, or do you prefer another approach?
Yeah. And the answer is yes, you have to, right? If for production anyways.
No, I love this question. I love this question because I've done all of my releases in Docker on Linux.
Right. Okay. Different.
And so Docker doesn't mean Linux anymore, right? There's the Windows version. So you got to say Docker, Linux and Docker, or Docker and Linux.
You have to define your container, Linux or Windows.
Right. But with the caveat, so I'm using Kestrel to do that, right? Which is super fast. It's nice. I mean, it's very simple, right? It's not IIS. IIS is a hosting platform,
right?
Kestrel is a web server. It hosts web pages, right? And it doesn't even host static content. You have to add the .NET Core static content module or API, right, or middleware to actually host static content. So Kestrel does nothing but serve, accept HTTP requests and hand them off to a handler, right? So in that regard, it doesn't have things like security and proxying and a whole bunch of other stuff that we've known and love in IIS. So that being said, if you have a lot of customizations like modules and stuff on IIS, then I'd say sure, you don't have to necessarily go away from them. In fact, this was kind of the big surprise or the big kind of thing that made it click for me is that the way you host your .NET Core app in IIS is with a .NET Core module.
Right.
That proxies your request to your .NET Core API, DLL, whatever,
yep.
your app. Yeah.
Called the ASP.NET Core module, which is a little confusing because if you didn't know what you were looking for, how would you know that was it?
Yeah, right. I know. And the only way I knew is because I went into, I think, Visual Studio and I used the project template and that's how they configure it.
Yes,
they give you a web config. Right?
That is kind of nice, actually, I don't want to say clueless, but if you're not super plugged in, because this is not front page stuff in the documentation.
Right.
Your web project will do the right thing in Visual Studio by default when you click the IIS Express go. You know, you click the little... If you're a mouse guy like me, and you click the play button on IIS Express.
Please.
Yeah.
Right. Now, Kestrel's great for, development. Kestrel being the, like you said, the .NET Core-based web server that's really, the performance was the... We're going to make a very performant web server. And so in the official documentation, Microsoft will say that, hey, you can use Kestrel if your application's internal, totally behind the firewall. But this is, to me, clear as day, right? If you expose your application to the internet, you must use IIS, Nginx, or Apache as a reverse proxy server.
Put something in front of it. Yep.
So, today, you must. And so, your original question, I made the mistake of reading Windows into that.
Yep.
But if you're on Windows, it's not only does it make sense, you're going to read this article about how to set up Kestrel behind IIS and make sure you pay close attention because it is not a hardened web server.
Yeah. Well, so what you just said, so we talked about, I think, two different things, right? The module, the IIS module that actually shells out to your application. There's no Kestrel involved there, right?
Right.
And then there's this thing you're talking about, which is actually running Kestrel in kind of another process and then having IIS kind of proxy request to that thing. So you're not running your ASP.NET Core application in IIS. You're running behind IIS. Is that correct?
Right.
Is that the correct paraphrase?
IIS is your reverse proxy that sends requests along to Kestrel, right, in its own process. I mean, IIS is kind of a process manager.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
But, so is it right to say then Kestrel is kind of like a runtime? Your web host.
It's like this, the guys over on the Linux side, the guys and gals on the Linux side are used to hosting something in a fast, tight web server written in Ruby and then putting that behind Nginx because Nginx is your web server that's ready to defend against attacks and let you install certificates and do your port bindings and all that stuff. It's a common... and I'm not saying out of experience, just out of research, this is a common pattern where, us Microsoft guys are so used to stand up IIS.
Well, there's really no choice, right?
There's no other choice, right?
You run Apache, but that was never a good option.
Right.
And never wrote a document.
I feel like at first it seemed like the ASP.NET team was committed to saying, hey, that's a good model because it gives you the best of both worlds. Host behind the big production-ready server or, host behind Nginx or something. Not that that's not production-ready. And that way you don't have to spend the time rebuilding all that stuff.
Right.
Let the people who are good at it do that.
Right. Well, and it's simple, right? And so you've got Kestrel, which all it does is handle HTTP requests, right? It is an HTTP implementation. It deals with sockets and writing to sockets and reading from sockets and all that stuff. And it provides you the kind of bare minimum abstraction that translates those HTTP requests and your responses into a .NET API that you can interact with, right? Other than that, right. Don't worry about anything else. Let something else, something more mature, something or the thing of your choice, right? You keep naming several things that can stand as this reverse proxy in front of the server, so you can choose whichever one you want, right? And you can switch.
Right.
You can go to Nginx, you can go to Apache, you can go to IIS, and you can choose whichever is best for your situation, but running Kestrel the whole time behind the scenes, right? So you kind of pick and choose which tools are appropriate for your situation.
Another thing to keep in mind, too, is in a production environment, a lot of times it's not the developer setting up IIS.
Yeah.
So having that abstraction layer makes a lot of sense, right?
Yep.
You're worried about your little world. You plug in with a module, and then if you're going to configure it, obviously you configure yourself, but if it's the admin or whatever, the server, you're not necessarily... It's just going to work. It's going to be less friction.
Yeah. And I will say, going back to the template, the project template and the web config file, that was something that when I was kind of confused. It really kind of raised my eyebrows. The first ASP.NET Core application that I created in Visual Studio with that template, and... There's you know, everybody's talking about it's not IIS, it's cross-platform, blah, 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 blah. It's a rewrite. It's not the old .NET framework you're used to. And this was back when you had the project.json file and all of that stuff, right? And yet there is this web config, which web config is very specific to IIS. And I just kind of flipped out. What is this doing here, right? And you open it up. Sure enough, it's the XML format that, you know, is all for IIS. But then it made perfect sense because it's exactly what you said, Chris. It's there if you need it. It is classic, like falling into the pit of success. This is just kind of configured. If you do an xcopy deploy of this folder and drop it into IIS, it'll just work. And if you don't, then you have a file there that sits there and doesn't do anything. It's not hurting anybody. You know, it's completely extraneous. So that web config file is only for hosting an IIS.
And it's been streamlined. It doesn't have the 5,000 lines of XML like we're used to.
Yeah. There's literally, it's like, it's maybe got a couple of configuration lines and then the registration of the ASP.NET Core module. What was it?
It's called the ASP.NET. It is called the ASP.NET Core module.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, man, I just find that to be a tough name because ASP.NET Core already has a meaning.
Yeah.
And module. Yes. Is like the word manager or provider or factory that's so generic.
Yeah.
It's so, like you almost want it to be called the ASP.NET Core IIS hookup.
Yeah, right. the hookup.
Web host hookup.
So going back to the question, kind of a yes or no, or what is your choice? So when you are writing your applications, what do you... So the original question was, does it make sense to run on IIS? But when you are ready to deploy your applications, where do you prefer to deploy them? What is your kind of preferred hosting platform for your .NET Core applications now? Todd?
I haven't deployed any yet in production, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Again, it would be based on the environment. If I'm running in Windows, I'd use IIS. If I'm going to run in Linux, it would be Nginx.
You mean just like your existing infrastructure, your client's existing infrastructure? Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
So, and I actually did look real quick while we were looking around for the Windows Nano Server, which is Microsoft's equivalent to a lot of the stuff that's going on in the Linux world. It looks like it still uses IIS too.
No.
I thought originally that was a different version.
No. Right. No, Nano does not have IIS.
That was just what I looked up. It said
it's going to support
IIS.
ASP.NET Core for sure. To be honest, I'm a little behind on Nano.
It says installing IIS on Nano servers online.
It has it has IIS? I thought it did not. I'm sorry. It does not have .NET Core or
.NET Framework.
The full version of .NET Framework. Yeah. Yes.
Like
yes,
you could not put ASP.NET 4.6 on there.
Yes, yes. No. I'm sorry. I misspoke. I was very much, because I looked into Nano server and I was very disappointed that I could not deploy my full. My .NET 4X application to Nano because of that reason. I had forgotten and thought it was because it was a lack
and
of
IIS. It's my understanding when you work with Windows containers, they are Nano servers.
No, there's two. There's Nano Server and then there's Windows Server Core.
Okay.
Which is a small version of the full Windows Server, which has... So Nano, I think, is like 8 megs or 80 megs.
Yeah, it's supposed
or
to be a headless web server kind of thing.
Yes.
5 very low. Megs or something.
They basically stripped out the 32-bit support. Any of the 32-bit libraries or anything, it's pure 64-bit. And apparently that's the biggest thing that cut down on the size and the weight. And that's also the thing that the full .NET framework needs. And if it's not there, you literally can't install .NET 4X.
Well, that's because .NET framework still relies on some COM stuff, which is 30-bit. Yeah,
exactly.
The Windows 32 runtime. Yeah, makes sense.
Right. As opposed to the Windows Server Core, which is just a small version of Windows Server, you know, headless, no UI stuff. So they stripped out a bunch of stuff there, but the 32-bit libraries are still there, and more importantly, the full .NET framework is still there. So you can take your – I've done this too. More, I haven't actually done it to production, but just as an exercise, I've taken my .NET 4X applications and deployed them to a Windows Server Core Docker container, and it's good. I'm not going to say it's great. It's good because it's huge. I think it's several gigs. Each container is still several gigs large. It still takes like 40 some seconds to boot up. Like, it's still pretty insane. It's almost like hosting a VM. You know, you don't really have a lot of, you might have the management capability, a little better management experience. But other than that, in terms of resources, it's not that much better, but it is in the right direction.
And all this stuff is evolving tech, so
it's not
solidified yet.
It's only going to get better. So what about you, Chris? When you run your, when you deploy your .NET Core apps, what are you looking to do? IIS?
Well, I think almost all the time, you know, your web server, your HTTP server is going to be Kestrel. If you're on Windows, you have to do IIS. And probably if I was on Linux, I would look at the Nginx one first. It just seems that that's where that Linux community really likes to be. I mean, Apache's there, and a lot of enterprises, they have a lot of familiarity with Apache. So that's not a horrible thing if you've already got like a data center and some experts and you don't want to become the expert. So you say, oh yeah, you know, here's some docs for using Apache. But there aren't a whole lot of alternatives here, right? Like there's Kestrel, which was built on a cross-platform HTTP server library. And then there's Web Listener, but that's only for Windows, and it's based on HTTP Sys. Now, the Web Listener option is there if you absolutely say, I don't want to use IIS. And Microsoft even sort of like self-hosting, but not really. It's like, it's built on HTTP Sys. You still have to set it up on your Windows server, and supposedly HTTP Sys is hardened against attacks. It's interesting. The only advice you get is like, it's an alternative you can use for scenarios when you want to expose your app to the internet, but you can't use IIS. And I go, well, you have Windows.
So it's free. Oh,
maybe you're on Nano.
Yeah. I don't know. It's funny because that's the why. That technically, that's the answer to why would you use this? But now I have the second question, which is why? Yeah. Like, what's the real why? Yeah, what's the scenario where you say, no.
Right.
Here's where I would absolutely do this. I don't know. Right. So
I think I'm more along the lines of Todd's answer. I think it's really like whatever you have. And I think that's the beauty of this approach too, right? And that's the beauty of Kestrel or even self-hosting of, you know, at this point you're just implementing HTTP and you're opening some ports, and then you can put whatever you want in front of it. And the cross-platform nature of .NET Core means you can host onto whatever environment. So really it's just, well, what servers do you have? It's not
I'll
that
tell
simple.
You what I'm, yeah.
Because
I'll tell
to your
you what
point,
I'm interested
Chris,
in
you
is,
have to configure it, right?
Right. But here's what I'm interested in. And see, this is the problem. We talk a lot about, we want to make sure that the show is about taking what we say to work. And I just wonder how many of us, our work environments are ready to say, forget all this, man. We're going platform as a service, and we'll use Docker. And that doesn't absolve you of setting this up correctly, but you've got Docker images that have already got it set up, and you're just kind of tinkering around the edges.
Yeah. Yeah, but so there is setup, right? There is investment, right. In
that's true.
When you pick one of these solutions, it's not just a I'll use Nginx right. today. Yeah, I'm done. No, yeah, it's yeah. Now you got to configure Nginx, which is
you got to go figure that out.
Different from Apache, which is different from IIS, which is if we all come from Windows and IIS backgrounds, well, why aren't you using IIS?
Yeah, right.
So yeah,
again, it's a whole new landscape, right?
Yeah,
because when previously in the .NET world, well, we were Windows, we weren't really thinking about
these
environments and the choices. I think ultimately it comes down to, like any good thing, what is the right architecture approach for your solution for what you're trying to solve?
Yep.
So and then do the research and figure it out. The good thing is you now have a choice, right? You talked a little while ago about you wrote something in Node previously. You were like, okay, well, I guess I'll use Ruby. I had to go to a completely different environment.
Mm-hmm.
Not just learning Nginx, I had to also learn a new environment, a new runtime, new coding stuff. So now, at least with .NET Core, I have a path to have to work in an environment I'm familiar with.
Yeah. All right, so speaking of Linux, running applications in Linux, and just kind of general cross-platform support, now, putting cross-platform support aside for a little bit, but just kind of speaking about the broad spectrum of what the .NET Core supports and kind of bridging the gap between .NET Full and everything, here's a question that I get a lot, and frankly, I'm still not entirely clear. At least I can't explain it. I think I might understand it, but the question is, I get that .NET Standard is an attempt to bridge the gap. Don't laugh when I say .NET Standard.
And this is the last question we'll be taking today, folks.
hold your laughs.
It's
until
a three-hour show.
I get that .NET Standard is an attempt to bridge the gap between the various editions of the .NET framework. But how does it actually affect us? What is the practical application? What's the practical application of .NET Standard? Who wants to take this? who wants to explain it?
Like I said, listeners, you do know this is a 3-hour episode, and the rest
and
of
we
this,
still will not answer it in 3 hours.
The rest of this time is just devoted to .NET Standard.
I have kind of related or follow up question. I have some. this was the cross platform thing. I have some existing C# libraries that I would like to try on .NET Core for possible use on Linux. Any advice?
Right.
And this was one of those questions that they had asked you, Chris, from your .NET, your cross-platform.
Right. And so they had watched, like, hey, it looks like you're coding in Linux, so how would I move my libraries over? And my answer was basically, hey, you need to research .NET Standard.
Yeah.
And so .NET Standard.
And then you threw out some links and said,
and you threw out some links
fun.
And said, so here you go, research .NET Standard, right? So like, what the heck, right? We've got .NET Core, and that has a bunch of version numbers, and then we have .NET Framework. And so what the heck is .NET Standard about? And one of the ways I think of .NET Standard, there's two things that I sort of tell myself. One is that similar to an interface in C#, a .NET Standard version defines available APIs. And so over time, the .NET framework has grown. And not only has it grown, it has supported different platforms like Silverlight, or the new Universal Windows platform, or Xamarin, or Mono, and now .NET Core. And so these different platforms, these different .NETs, they do have things in common. And as time has gone by, they might have more in common, or they have larger API surfaces that are in common. But when these things were created, especially if we go back in time, nobody was thinking about that. Right. So .NET Standard is an attempt to say, or it is a way to say, if we define a .NET Standard version, and this has nothing to do with versions of .NET Framework or anything else, .NET Standard 1.0 represents this set of APIs, and we can also define, we now know which platforms can target that, such as Windows Phone 8.1 and Xamarin for iOS 10.0. And then if we expand the API set a little bit, we can create another, we can say this .NET Standard version with a little bit more expansion is .NET 1.1, and this is .NET 1.2, and here's where we bring in enough API surface that the .NET framework 4.5.1 works, and Windows 8.1 works. So what's really confusing about this is if you've heard of the term, either like creating a backronym where you say what an acronym that you made up, you've already defined the acronym, but now you decide what it means, or retconning, like a movie writer tries to fix continuity after the fact. .NET standard's kind of like retconning for .NET. You go back and you define, well, here's standard 1.0, and we're heading all the way back to Windows Phone for Silverlight for Windows Phone. But see, .NET standard 1.1, that's not going to ever run on Silverlight for Windows Phone because the world had moved on.
Right.
And 1.2 is where you finally get Windows 8.1 APIs. And 1.3 gets you to .NET Framework 4.6 along with compatibility with other stuff. And .NET Core 1.0, you know, supports .NET standards 1.0 through 1.6. And then to try and make like a clean break and bring everything together, not that Microsoft's never done that before, .NET Standard 2.0, which is being published, is going to be the API surface for .NET Core 2.0 and .NET Framework 4.6.1, and then the next versions of some other things like Xamarin and UWP. This is like a way to clean up after the mess that was portable class libraries. And there's going to be plenty of folks listening to this who are like, yeah, I sort of know what those are, or maybe you don't. And portable class libraries was an idea that if you write your APIs, if you write your libraries a certain way, they will be compatible across hardware platforms, or maybe not necessarily hardware platforms, but platforms like Xamarin and Xbox and
different versions
Silverlight
of the framework
and so on. Yeah. And the way PCLs worked is a union. I'm sorry, not a union. I guess they were a union of what was common. So what ended up happening is you as a developer had to foresee what platforms you wanted to run on. And then when a new platform came out, you were instantly not compatible.
Well, and you had to explicitly choose.
You had to choose up front. And
these platforms or the 10 platforms or the two.
Right. I want my app to run on .NET Framework 4.5, Windows Phone 8.1, and Xbox. And I'm not sure who's making these decisions. They're the kinds of decisions that are being made by folks like James Newton King building JSON.NET.
Libraries. Very low-level library type stuff.
The libraries that everybody absolutely wants, right? You know, I want it on my phone, and I want it on Xamarin, and I want it on Windows, and I want it on .NET Core. So, like, the really hard question here is, should you care?
Right. So, practically, I mean, how am I going to use this? How do I consume .NET standard?
Right. And I think my answer, and then I'll let you guys answer since I've talked enough, is if your organization has traditionally cared about portability, well, then you probably are knee-deep in PCL, Portable Class Library, already, and you should care.
So if I've never even heard of the term PCL, I probably don't care?
You probably care less. The only way where you might care is if you say, going forward, I'm super excited about my code running in multiple platforms like .NET Core and Xamarin, which might be a use case. Maybe you should pay attention. But
and
if you're
how
like,
how do I pay attention? So if I do fall under that, what are the practical steps I take? What do I click on in Visual Studio?
Yeah,
I don't think there's anything you click on. I think you have to basically adhere to the spec. I don't think there's really any tooling yet.
Well,
with the PCL, there was some tooling.
Don't you also declare your library, like your project type? Not your project type, your project target changes, and there's all these and I don't have the list memorized, but now instead of having to remember PCO profiles, it's like learning, well, am I targeting Net Core App 1.0 or am I targeting Net Standard 2.0? Because you could just say this library is going to target Net Standard 2.0, and now you're compatible with things like .NET Framework 4.6.1 and .NET Core 2.0. Or you're like, we're not thinking that far ahead. This library targets, I think that's right. I think that in the CS proj file, you'll see it say Net Core App 2.0 or something similar.
Yeah.
That's basically drawing a line in the sand saying this library supports .NET Core 2.0. And if it happens to support something else, that's great. But you're not trying to make that happen. And
so I literally just in Visual Studio 2017, I created a new library. And then if I have that drop down list of target framework selections, I have .NET Standard 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, all the way up to 2.0. Because like I said earlier, I installed the latest. Yeah.
That's nice. It's in the tooling.
The preview,
that's cool.
The edition. Yeah. That's in the class library, though. So my class library, to your point, right. Chris, about PCLs, the libraries themselves, the shared libraries,
right.
That's my class library. This same dropdown and this same Visual Studio instance with target frameworks in, say, an ASP.NET Core web application has .NET frameworks, not .NET Standard.
Right.
Which .NET framework do you want? Do you want full? Do you want 4.6? Do you want 4.62? Do you want .NET Core?
Right. So that project should be your end, you know, your end game, your edge facing project, whether that's a web API or it's a GUI.
Your executable.
Right.
Yeah. Your host, yeah.
Right.
I think
executables are never going to be .NET Standard.
Right.
Right.
Because
that's when you decide you're picking a platform. Yeah, I'm targeting this platform. I'm targeting UWP. Who targets UWP? I'll leave that aside.
Wait, that's another show, right?
Obviously, Apple, because iTunes is going to be in the Windows Store. Come on.
Yeah, look at that. iTunes is coming to the Windows Store.
Yeah.
Whatever amazing. Microsoft pays someone to do it. I don't. When I look into a lot of this stuff, what I feel like is, because a lot of us come from the web background, this wasn't something we cared about. If you worked in the WPF world and like Chris was saying, in the Xbox and the Windows client type world, portable class libraries has been around for a few years, and it always felt very broken. It's sort of something you used, but you never quite understood how it worked or why it worked that way. So I look at .NET Standard as a way for them to try to simplify that, to make it more clear.
Simplify by adding another concept.
Anyway, yeah. To me, the bigger problem is the whole versioning, because now we got like all these different versions of things.
Right. No, I literally just tuned out. I don't mean to be offensive, Chris, but I just tuned out when you just listed a whole bunch of versions. You're like .NET Core 1.2, but .NET Full 4.62, and I can't hear all these versions.
It's not great for the radio. I will agree with you there. The only way to really do it is to look at a matrix.
The chart.
Yeah,
the
matrix. Like that's the only way is you have to look at the chart and then ponder on it for some time.
So again, if you're the typical ASP.NET Core developer today, probably the time you care about is if you're going to consume a library or you are going to write the library that you need to work in .NET Full and Core.
Yeah.
Then this is relevant to you. If you are just PCL one case. Or the other, then it's irrelevant to you. Right? Yeah. If you're just writing your normal line of business type application, this is less important today. But like Chris said earlier on, maybe someday it won't be as maybe more and more important down the line.
Yeah.
So I think the bigger problem is all the version numbers just add confusion, and it just
I know. It's a whole new set of version numbers.
And .NET Core's already had this problem because sometimes you'll see a version number for the SDK and the tooling and the CLI, and they're all different.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem for me is I'm willing to bet that most, the strong majority of developers are developing those not shared libraries, those client facing, those end apps, and therefore never really care about this. Like they just consume, they consume libraries that implement .NET Standard, but they really see them in NuGet or whatever, and they just take it. Yeah, is it compatible with my current product? Yes or no? Cool. NuGet just kind of figures that out for me.
Right.
And they just take it, and they don't even know or care that it's .NET Standard. It's the people who are producing libraries that care, right?
It's more of a problem for Microsoft. They created all these different ecosystems, so they have to solve it for themselves.
Right. They obviously care, right? My point is, it's one of those concepts that's another concept in the ecosystem that I actually don't, for the vast majority of my day-to-day job, I don't need to care about ever.
Yeah, that's
except
true.
For when I do. And then I have to learn it, right?
And the worst part is how will you know when you do?
Right.
When you go to run something and it doesn't work the way you want, and you're like, oh, okay.
Yep.
So
I wonder if this is that .NET Standard thing.
Moving on, so talking about development of cross-platform applications and development on Linux. So this is getting kind of back to that talk that you gave for PostShop, Chris. So what do you use to code your .NET Core apps? And do you use different tools on Windows or Mac or Linux? What's out there? What's available?
I think for entertainment value or even just for learning, I've spent some time in Visual Studio Code, and that includes Windows. But part of the reason that was to understand what it would be like to live in that space of, okay, I want to be cross-platform and I want to code in Linux with Visual Studio Code. What happens when I bring that back to Windows? What happens when I take it over to Linux? And it turns out it's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
You can even take a Visual Studio made project and then just throw it up in GitHub or something, head over to your Linux box, pull it down. It works fine.
And vice versa. Save it back. And
yeah. And Visual Studio Code will even do some cool stuff there. Like if it detects a solution file,
it says,
oh, you've got multiple projects in here. And the interface kind of it pivots slightly to be project based. And you can add projects and remove them. It's not as fancy as the right click stuff in Visual Studio.
No, it's not an IDE.
Right.
Yeah, that's the whole
point. And to be honest, if you're willing to take the time to do a right click operation in Visual Studio and then go see what happened in the CS proj, it's pretty readable now.
Yeah.
It's very hand editable.
Yeah.
You're just not going to know what to do until you see an example.
Yep.
Or go look at the docs, but let's be honest, we're not going to do that.
Right.
We're going to open a brand new project. We're going to add a reference. We're going to say, what does it do?
Yes.
And then we'll go back and hand edit our other ones. Yeah.
Right.
But that's how you learn, right? To a degree.
Right.
So.
Right.
So Todd, you've never even touched a Mac in your life, right?
I have touched a Mac a few times. I've done a little bit of professional development a long time ago. No, I mean, I am Visual Studio Cadillac. That's a term I think I coined on our podcast a long time ago, and it's the tooling I have, and I've used code occasionally, but I'm like, why use the little Tinker toy set when I have Cadillac sitting there already?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could deploy to Linux right out of that thing too.
Yeah, so I mean,
and debug.
I think it's cool that code's there. I think it definitely, there's a marketplace for it, and obviously if you're going to end up on Linux, right, there's no Visual Studio for Linux yet, but there is now a Mac version. So.
But there is Visual Studio for Mac.
I kind of look at it from a different perspective, which is, even though I may not have an interest in using these type of tooling, I think it's good that Microsoft's brand is getting expanded out there.
Yes.
And I do know that some people that do a lot of Xamarin development stuff, previously it was kind of more challenging to get stuff to work, so it looks like they're doing a much better job of getting the tooling to work more across all these different platforms and things. So, again, while I may never end up running any Xamarin type stuff, it's still good that the ecosystem is growing and the Microsoft brand is getting out there. So it's a positive for me, even though it's not necessarily impacting me today.
Right. I agree. I absolutely love Visual Studio Code. I spend most of my time in it lately, but that is because I'm spending most of my time writing my spy applications, my client-side code, you know, TypeScript and Angular 2 and stuff. So I absolutely adore Visual Studio Code. I have used it to edit .NET Core solutions on Linux and on Windows, and what I can really say there is that the experience is very consistent no matter what platform you're on, whether you're Mac, Windows, Linux, with Visual Studio Code. You're getting the same exact experience, which is pretty cool. And the experience is pretty robust. They've got there's a lot of features there, especially when you compare it to if you're used to doing kind of Node.js development, right? Mm-hmm. Or I guess Ruby development or something, you know, in text-based and Visual Code, not in a full-blown IDE. Basically, if you don't really know any better, you know, if you've been using Node.js and you're comfortable using just basically an enhanced text editor, and you're going to the command line and pulling in dependencies from the command line interface and all that stuff, then Visual Studio Code is a real nice experience. And doing when you go to a .NET Core solution and you get a lot of IntelliSense and autocomplete and CodeLens and all this cool stuff, it's a really cool experience, right? It's much better than that experience that you're used to with Node. But then if you open full-blown Visual Studio, the Visual Studio Code experience is nothing. I mean, it doesn't even hold a candle to it because it's not an IDE, right? So it's at that point, you're not even comparing apples to apples. So it's Visual Studio Code is great for what it is. Visual Studio full blown, you know, on Windows continues to be amazing. Now, as you guys both have mentioned, there's Visual Studio for Mac, which I've used for all of about 20 minutes.
that may be more than most people.
When I opened it up, those 20 minutes were spent very much evaluating it, going through and kind of, I was very selective about the parts of the tools, the features that I was evaluating, because those were the things that had been absent in previous cross-platform solutions, stuff that I have gotten really used to in the full-blown version on Windows. And as I went through and kind of hit my punch list of those features that I really kind of need to be there in a full-blown IDE and that I expect to be there, it hit them all. And it was a really great experience. So I'm not going to go on record as saying there's like full parity between the Windows and the Mac versions of Visual Studio.
Yeah, but man, but Miguel is on it.
It's a great experience. Yeah, it's great. There's a lot of parity, and I will go so far as to say there is parity on the really major features, the really nice features, the ones you're going to be using all the time.
Knowing that Miguel De Acasa is on it,
yeah,
I expect it to be pretty good.
Yep.
I mean, it already sounds like it's pretty good, and he's just he's relentless about developer experience. Look at how just in the last 3 years or so, I would say, besides being acquired by Microsoft, they've been relentless about saying the whole experience of being an iOS developer and having your Windows laptop and turning to your Apple laptop. He even hated that friction.
Yeah.
And slowly but surely, now they're like, oh, well, you know, go put your Apple machine over there, hook up to it, and then we'll bring the emulator up locally. Yep. We'll compile remotely. You just go put it in a closet somewhere.
Yeah.
And I feel like knowing his passion for developer experience, watch out, Visual Studio for Mac. Watch out.
Yeah.
Yeah, which also is good, because as they prove that experience, they'll eventually bring a lot of it back to Windows too. So again, it's all about the idea that there's options, right? We're no longer a closed platform. That was always a big negative to the Microsoft world. Oh, you're closed stuff. No, our platform is open. We are not restricted. We can do what we need to do.
So we're not restricted. We still have the choice between .NET Full framework and .NET Core. So to pull the whole show together and go back to that teaser of the number one question that everybody asks, it's still on everybody's mind.
Yep.
All the things that we've done so far in our application, I'm reading the question now, are already available in the .NET framework, the full .NET framework that we've known and loved for 15 years. That's my elaboration.
Yes.
On a mature and robust code base in a very elegant and easy manner. So apart from the cross-platform support, why should we go for .NET Core? What is your answer, Todd? Why should you go for .NET Core today?
So for me, the answer is containers and cloud. That's the relevance to me. The idea that if I want to move to container type architecture, which seems to be gaining more and more popularity, Core seems to be the best option. The only other thing to me with Core is what I've heard from performance. That ASP.NET Core performance is significantly higher than the current ASP.NET stack. Those really are the two things.
Yeah.
But neither one of them, I mean, I've done a little bit of thing with containers, but none of them are things I'm doing on a day-to-day basis today. So who knows? By the time I get around to doing that when that's more of my day-to-day activity, then Core may not necessarily be the best option then. Today, if I had tomorrow came to me and said, I want to do this, then Core would be my option.
What about you, Chris?
If I look at the first part of the question, I'm going to infer that if you have an existing solution on .NET Framework, it's working well, maybe there's no need to rush. We're not saying rewrite it. In fact, I don't think anybody you really ever want to do that. So why go for .NET Core? Well, it's a consideration to make on a greenfield app, but now that begs the question, is it ready? And I think the answer has to be, is it ready for you? You know, if you pointed out, Jess, you wanted SignalR, well, maybe it's not time yet, because today your solution would involve, if you absolutely wanted to stay with SignalR, is keeping a .NET framework SignalR server and then talking to it from some .NET Core. And that you know, you might think that's a mess. I think even besides the performance, I really do feel there has been some cleanup in the programming model. If we just talk about the syntax, I know that there's a little bit of like, where did it go? Who moved this? I'm not sure how to do this now. But all in all, my opinion is that even if you went from ASP.NET MVC 5 on the ASP.NET 4.6 stack, and then you looked at the ASP.NET Core MVC that you build, I think all in all, you're happier with the ASP.NET Core MVC, at least I am. And that even goes for other parts of the stack too. So that, and again, I'm avoiding the cross-platform part because the question said apart from that.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things where as a personal developer, you have to ask yourself, or is this what my employer or employers are going to be asking for, or clients going to be asking for in the coming years? And really, I just don't want to echo Todd's answer because I'm all about platform as a service. I love platform as a service, and I love how .NET Core, pretty quickly, you say, okay, I've got my .NET Core app. I've got it in a Docker image that's, you know, Microsoft's providing Docker images for me to build on, and I've got it running in something like, could be Azure Container Service, could be Azure Web Apps for Linux, or let's head over to a different cloud, and it still works.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of neat, and it's up and running quick. You can get it all going with your continuous integration. Heck, you can even start using Travis CI, and you're doing all this continuous stuff where, like, I'm checking into GitHub, and all this magic is happening, and my website is being built. Not sure that that's production ready, but it sure is fun as a lone developer who wants to take idea to execution and just see that happen. It's really nice to keep your little project going. It keeps you from stopping because, oh, I got to go deploy this. No, you don't. It's deployed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
the bigger question, if I inject real quick, is what is the future of .NET full? Is there going to be a 5.0 version? Is there going to be a 5.1 right. version? Or at some point, they're going to say, like, hey, it's done. We're going to focus more and more on core. And over the last 5 or 6 years, Microsoft hasn't really answered that question.
Right. If the question is, why should we go for .NET Core? Yeah, you got to think of that. Well, you know, you're assuming that the full .NET framework is going to stay there, is going to be there, is going to be there for you, to support you for, you know.
So I'll put in the show notes a Q&A panel that Scott Hunter's on where he uses the words forever. And he has a reason. He has a reason. His reason is that the .NET framework is the platform that not only supports Windows Server, but also Windows Client. And the Windows Client continues to evolve. The .NET framework has to continue forward, and it's not going away. Now, I'm not asking you all to take that to the bank. I'm just saying we'll put that in the show notes so everybody can hear the answer out of his mouth, right?
Which is the answer you expect Microsoft to give. But it would still be good, like I said, the Greenfield project.
Sure.
Again, I guess it's like anything else, right? When did someone first decide to use MVC? Because it was, I want to use this. It makes sense.
Yeah, right.
You just kind of take the leap in and...
Well, here's the thing, right? .NET framework, at its conception, had... And we're talking 2000, 2001 timeframe.
Yeah.
Its goals were to get you into a managed VM where you could write WinForms and web forms. That's the foundation on which .NET framework was built.
On Windows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even though over time, in an odd twist of fate, both the .NET framework and Java have become server-side platforms when they were both intended at their very core to be client-side. That's what they were built on. That was their genesis. .NET Core, from day one, its whole mission is server-optimized runtime.
Yeah,
cloud optimized runtime.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
It doesn't have so. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, obviously .NET framework hasn't served us well. It has, but that wasn't in its DNA. And .NET Core's the blueprint, the step one mission was cloud optimized runtime. So I feel like we'll always have the advantage of being leaner, meaner, and more cloud ready. And more container ready, packed VM ready, whatever technology you want to use to be more efficient. that .NET Framework will never quite be there because you forever and ever, you'll always have to install the thing.
Yeah, well, right. And we already touched on it earlier. The reason it's not on Nano Server is because right now, at least today, you can't install it without 32-bit APIs, and they don't exist on Nano Server, right?
Yeah.
So when we're saying it's there forever, does that mean that they are going to fix that 32-bit dependency problem, or it's going to be there, the 32-bit APIs are going to be there forever in order to support .NET, the full .NET framework, right? Like something's got to give there at some point. I just don't believe forever. I don't believe it.
Well, I mean, forever is a weird term, right? I mean, Windows XP is support it forever in certain cases. Right. So,
well, when does Windows end?
Because that too.
Because WPF is still there, and the .NET Framework 4.7 has APIs that let you do whatever came in that creators update.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, so I think touch on that. That's a whole other.
So deal. There's going to be a fall creators update, and I'm sure there will be a .NET Framework following behind that.
Yeah.
Yep. Sure.
So I think for me, you had mentioned you made the kind of parallel, or you mentioned adopting ASP.NET MVC when it came out. Right.
Yeah.
So when developers come out. So with any technology, of course, you can't ignore there's the coolness factor. There's the new factor. There's I want to be on the new technology.
Right?
But that aside, assuming you're taking a critical look at any new technology and seeing if it is a fit for you, I think what really attracted a lot of developers, certainly attracted me to ASP.NET MVC, was the implementation of the MVC pattern.
Yep.
Right. And the availability of that pattern and moving away from the web pages pattern. Or the page model pattern, or the front controller pattern, whatever you want to call it, right?
Yeah.
The web forms pattern.
The post back hell
pattern, the code behind pattern. Yeah. Yeah. That sloppy mess that was.
Yeah.
You could do web pages correctly, but.
Threw the door open to the web to VB6 programmers.
Yes. Yes. So if you want an alternative to that pattern that was nice, clean, separation of concerns, right, solid code, all of that stuff kind of built into the core essence and driver and principles of the framework, that's why they went there, right? And so in .NET Core, there are some of those things. So first and foremost for me is dependency injection, right? It's a core part of the framework. So ASP.NET MVC added that, you know, it's everything is dependency injected and it's there and it's available to use. But now we're talking about going below the web, you know, going below the MVC framework, going below the web framework to the core framework. Dependency injection is just there. It's built in from the ground up, which is pretty amazing. Right. And also kind of pulling in only the packages you need, being nice and lightweight. That's got its pros and cons. But I think for me, those are all really nice. For me, you can't really ignore the cross-platform support. That kind of is the reason. Whether or not you want to be cross-platform right now, the ability to go cross-platform at any point is really nice. And not for specifically the ability of like, I want to go from Windows infrastructure today to Linux infrastructure. But as both of you guys have mentioned, Docker infrastructure, container infrastructure, right? Containers are revolutionary. They will transform the way that we do development very soon, right? In the next couple of years, it's still kind of nascent. Even though the technology is pretty mature now, it's still nascent. Like, it is going to take over, containers are just going to be the way that we're doing development. And as I mentioned earlier, you can take a full framework application and host it in a Windows Server Core Docker container, but that container is going to be 3-4 gigs big, and it's going to take 40 seconds to load up. And just the antithesis of everything that containers stand for. If you want to host in a container, or forget to your point, Chris, forget about containers, just platform as a service, and you don't care what that underlying platform is, whether that's IIS or on Windows or Linux or whatever.
I don't want to care about it. Yeah.
I don't want to care about it. Right. So it's an abstraction. It's an abstraction from the platform. So it's not the ability to go to any platform. It's the ability to not care about what platform you're on.
Yeah. Platform abstonic, right?
Yeah. And so I think that's why if you're starting a new application today, I would say go for .NET Core because of that, because it is mature enough, right? It's ready. It's production ready. It's a V2 now. Well, almost V2. The APIs are certainly there. The framework's certainly there. The community is there. You know, everything is there. And the cross-platform support is there when you need it, right? And it's just one less thing to worry about. And plus, you got some nice stuff like DI built in.
Yeah. I think the piece of advice I would have is go ahead and jump. I think this is right, Jess, is go ahead and jump to .NET Core 1.1 and ASP.NET Core.
Sure.
Because that way you're at least in CSproj land, sure, and you won't have to do that migration from XProj that shipped with 1.0.
Sure. Yep.
Like, at least do yourself that favor.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Avoid the friction.
Yeah, I know. So I've been choosing .NET Core in a lot of my server-side projects lately. And really, I sit down and make the decision, do I want to go full? Do I want to go core? And I say, why not core? Right. And so that's for me. That's my personal projects. Like, I am planning on actually hosting them in production and having to support them, but certainly not like enterprise-level support. Right? I don't have those kind of concerns. But for me, it's a question of like, why not? Why would I invest in the full .NET framework when it's not really giving me anything specifically that I need? Right? Everything I need is available in .NET Core. So why wouldn't I just use it?
Are your server-side projects, are they mostly, I hate this term, are they mostly web APIs, or are you doing some MVC?
Almost exclusively web APIs, yeah.
Right.
Well,
right.
And so I'm telling this story, and I started off the whole podcast by telling the story of I went to go implement something and SignalR wasn't available. So I, so that rip aside, it has everything I need except SignalR.
Yeah.
But I hear you, right? Because it's interesting to think about, it's almost a good thing that they merged MVC and web API, although it's horribly confusing now because it's all called MVC. But what if you don't use, if you're doing no views?
In practice, unless it's not.
You consider the web API output a view, I guess, kind of, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
If you've been doing ASP.NET MVC and web API for years and you really know those models and the different classes,
you're fine. You're fine.
I'm saying, you're going to have to get used to the fact that you don't have the HTTP formatters and the different the different namespaces and everything. It's all one now. But you're fine in terms of, like, you're just going to be very comfortable. Just create a controller, return some data, respond to HTTP requests, and you got put, get, post, put, delete. You got that verb support. Respond with some data. You're done. You're good.
I mean, depending on how plugged in you are to the world, all your future projects might be SPA client and then web API backend anyway. But I still feel like sometimes I try to remember that I might be in this bubble of being connected and plugged in and really paying attention, because there's just so many shops out there that it's not even a consideration. They're just like, why would I want to do that? What's wrong with server-side websites? They work. Forms over data. Who cares?
No, for a couple of projects, I've done both, right? So for like the admin on the back end, I'll go and do a full page refresh or whatever, and I'll do full page form posts and server side rendering and everything. But then for the better client side experience, I'll have a web API, and I define that one service, that class that does all the service, and that's the thing I share. And effectively, it's two endpoints, right? It's the server side rendered endpoint, and it's that web API endpoint that I consume with whatever, Angular, jQuery, whatever.
That sounds like a good show there.
Yeah.
.NET, what's architecture with ASP.NET Core and modern frameworks?
Yeah. All right. But for this show, I think it's probably a wrap.
Yeah, it was meaty.
Yeah. You, listener, what questions do you have about .NET Core or really anything else that we've talked about? Please leave a comment on the website, staticvoidpodcast.com, or send an email to comments@staticvoidpodcast.com. Chris, Todd, thanks for the chat.
Yes, thank you, guys. Nice.
I'm glad to be back from our hiatus and start pumping out these shows again.
Absolutely.
Sounds good.
And thank you, listener, for spending the time with us. We hope that you enjoyed it, and we look forward to seeing you next time on the Static Void Podcast.